Did we get any emails? I haven't looked at that yet.
Nope.
Oh, man. Our email well has been very dry recently.
I know. We haven't made any mistakes recently.
Ah.
I actually thought about sending us in an email just so we'd have an email, but I leave it anonymous. But I wasn't that desperate.
1, 2, 3, hit it, boys!
Whoa! Get together, have a few laughs.
Uh-oh! Shit, lady, do I sound like I'm ordering a pizza?
Lady, put the freaking gun down on the ground right now, take your son across the freaking street, and say that until he's gonna get you!
Hello, and welcome to Where There's a Willis, There's a Way, a film podcast about the multitude of works by Bruce Willis. My name is Kendrick Martin.
And I'm Josh Carter. Today, we will be covering the film, The Fifth Element, instead of the philosophy, The Fifth Element, which is one of the things that pops up when you search for it on Wikipedia. This movie is directed and written by Luc Besson. If this is your first time listening to this podcast, what we'll do is an in-depth breakdown of a Bruce Willis movie, both from a film perspective as well as his individual contribution. We'll add the movie to our rankings, talk trivia, and whisk the Wheel of Willis. Also, drumroll please. Joining us this week is Rebecca Martin.
Hey, guys.
Hello. So glad you could be here with us tonight. How's it going?
It's good. Excited to be here, and I'm glad you guys invited me.
Absolutely. Really excited to talk about this movie. I'm excited to hear your opinions. And, yeah, I really am completely in the dark as to what you both will think about it. Rebecca, what's your feeling on Bruce Willis in general before we get going? Do you like him? Do you hate him? Do you care for him?
Do you want to kiss his shiny bald head?
Yeah. honestly, I feel like I'm pretty neutral on him. Like, none of his movies have ever really been something like jump out at me. But then I usually, when I go back and watch them, I'm always like pleasantly surprised. I'm like, oh, actually, you know, Bruce Willis is not that bad.
Well, if I could recommend Hudson Hawk to you, your tune may change and you will now be in love with him.
Okay.
We will never
good.
Shut up about that movie.
Yeah. I'm going to be a Hudson Hawk stan for as long as I can.
And this rest of the episode will be in rhyme all the time. I don't know.
Josh, that's a crime.
Oh my gosh.
Kendrick, you're such a slime.
Oh. I'm miming, right? Okay. listener, if this is your first time listening and you're still here with us, you can find our previous episodes by heading on over on your internet browser to williswaypod.com. We're also a part of the Last of the Action Heroes podcast network. You can find those podcasts over at lastoftheactionheroes.com. If you want to support us, besides the love that you can send us, what you can also send us is a iTunes rating. Preferably 5 stars, but the star is really up to you. What we really want is just those sweet, sweet ratings.
Unfortunately, you can't rate our podcast a Bruce Willis out of a Bruce Willis, but, you know, we're talking with Tim Apple about it, and we'll see what he says.
Mm-hmm. I feel like DJ Khaled calling into Apple being like, look, you got to boost the servers so I can add a new rating system.
Yeah, we got it. So yeah, before we fully get into this movie, we kind of like to give people a recommendation on whether or not we think that this movie is worth a watch before they listen to the rest of the podcast. Obviously, if you want to get spoiled, that is totally fine, but we came up with a way to rate movies, and we rate movies a Bruce Willis out of a Bruce Willis. So if we think it's a movie that's worth watching, it gets at least a Bruce. And then however many more letters it gets is kind of with the amount of gusto with which we'll recommend this movie. So, Kendrick, I'd love to hear what you think about this movie. How many letters out of Bruce Willis do you rank The Fifth Element?
Before we do me, Rebecca, are you familiar with the Bruce Willis rating system?
I am familiar.
Nice. Do you think it's the greatest rating system of all time? Like, should all things use this rating system?
All things, whether they have Bruce Willis involved or not, should definitely use this rating system.
I agree. This is where I think my legacy will be made, is in that that rating system.
Like, you'll have a Wikipedia entry and it'll be like, personal life. Kendrick was married and had cats. And then, like, the Willis ranking system is the majority of your article.
Yes. Yep. Josh, I don't know if you know this, but this is my Bruce Willis. This is the one movie that I've
this is your Bruce Willis?
A full Bruce Willis to.
This is your Bruce Willis?
This is my full Bruce Willis.
Oh, man. Oh, man. Well, you know what? I guess I'll just shut up the rest of this episode because I got some different opinions, bucko.
Yes.
I got some
tension.
Some mega different opinions.
Okay, well, what is your what do you rate this movie?
So, I'm going to also say that this movie is worth a watch. However, I'm thinking that I'm going to give this movie, and I'm going to look at my ratings before I just blindly say something out. But I think I'm going to give this movie a Bruce W.
So just barely.
Bruce W. Yeah.
Rebecca, how much of a Bruce Willis would you give this movie? Do you think this movie is worth people's time or
I definitely think it's worth people's time. It might depend on the type of person you are, but I would give it a solid also Bruce W.
Okay, well, I get some work to do.
Yeah, I have extra letters that I'm willing to give up, but I am not there yet. Not even close.
Nice. Well, that's good, because sometimes when we agree too much, we just sit here and applaud each other's great opinions.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Maybe what we should do is we should like hype this episode up as like the big fight between both of us. Mm-hmm. Maybe I should just go back and unrate that, and I'll rate it like just a B, and then it will be a truly a catastrophic event.
Or what's his first name? Walter?
A Walt.
Or something?
I'll give it a Walt.
Okay. This, I'm not kidding. When we started this podcast, this was the movie I've been looking forward to all 25 episodes from now.
Wow. So if we stopped recording this podcast, like if I got both my ears blown off in a U-Haul accident, then you would feel fulfilled.
Because
we would have recorded the episode that you set out to record.
That's like the darkest way you could put that, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, sure. I have no doubt that there will be, now that I've used my full Bruce Willis, I got infinite Bruce Willis's, new Bruce Willis Plus, as you would call it. So maybe if we find other great movies, I'll feel more comfortable using it. But
so are you equating this with like your virginity, like it's a really big deal the first time you use it, and then like from then on out you're like, yeah, well, I mean, I've already given a Bruce Willis out to something else, so
I wasn't thinking of it that way, but your analogy works.
Before we continue diving in, Rebecca, do you have a favorite Bruce Willis movie?
If you'd asked me that a few weeks ago, I probably would not have known, but I've been listening to you guys, and I listened to the Pulp Fiction one, because honestly, I forgot Bruce Willis was in Pulp Fiction, so being reminded of that fact, it would be Pulp Fiction, for sure.
Nice. Yeah, Pulp Fiction's one of those where I feel like it gets a really positive reception whenever it's talked about. There's obviously some problems with it, but I think that it's one of those movies that is correctly regarded instead of like a Hudson Hawk, which is just overly maligned. I feel like Pulp Fiction pretty much earns all the praise that is heaped upon it. So that has not surprised me, but I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. And I also think that the problems we had with it are analyzed and talked about. So
totally.
Whereas Hudson Hawk is just not talked about at all. Maybe we should just start a Hudson Hawk spinoff podcast where we just talk about that movie.
I could honestly do like a minute by minute breakdown of Hudson Hawk, I think.
Honestly, the little bit you guys have talked about it is making me want to watch it, and I've never even heard of this movie.
Well, you are in for a treat.
Okay, so here's the pitch. So it's a movie that Bruce Willis writes based on a jazz song that he and a buddy came up with, where they came up with this character named Hudson Hawk before they came up with the rest of the story. And then they're like, what if he's like a cat burglar spy character? I'm like, yeah. So it's an absolutely ridiculous movie, totally campy, totally over the top. Every single character is played at an 11, and Bruce Willis has a character that his secret superpower is that he knows the length of songs and he can sing in perfect time. So whenever he does a heist, he knows exactly which song to sing based on the amount of seconds that they have to do this event. And Richard E. Grant is in it, and he is phenomenal. And who else is in that movie, Kendrick, that's just amazing?
David Caruso.
Oh, yes. Oh, wow. Yeah, so this movie, it is bonkers. Like, if there's ever a movie to, like, sit down, have a couple sips of something or other, this is a movie to do that. But I think that if you are down to watch, like, think the 1960s Batman movie, but on, like, on something, and just going off the walls even more so than that campy, like, disaster/masterpiece, I think that you'll be in for a treat.
Wow. Okay.
What's funny was you could have been describing The Fifth Element when you first started out with.
I know, that's what I was thinking.
Over the top, everybody's playing at an 11.
That's exactly what I was thinking. I was about to say, and you didn't like this movie? Yeah.
But enough about The Fifth Element. All right. So, you listener can get a hold of us many ways, but our favorite ways are emails, willisswaypod@gmail.com, Twitter @willisswaypod, or the ever popular Instagram, also willisswaypod. And now let's dive into The Fifth Element.
Every 5,000 years.
Remove the shield.
When the three planets are in eclipse, the black hole, like a door, is open. Evil comes, spreading terror and chaos.
There's nothing that can stop this.
There is only one thing.
Perfect.
The Mondo Chiwan have in their possession the only weapon to defeat evil. Four elements. Gathered around a fifth.
They're here.
Hello.
Corbin, sweetheart. You got broken fingers, you can't punch my number?
I'm up.
Welcome on. Have a nice day.
Major Dallas, you're selected for a mission of the utmost importance.
What mission?
Save the world.
Is that thing solid?
Unbreakable.
Good.
Where are the stones?
I don't know. And even if I did know, I wouldn't tell somebody like you.
Nowhere else to go.
Hang on.
That audio was from the trailer of The Fifth Element. I'm going to read the description from IMDb. In a colorful future, a cab driver unwittingly becomes the central figure in the search for a legendary cosmic weapon to keep evil and Mr. Zorg at bay. You can find this movie for rent on VOD. I want to note that evil is capitalized there. It is not just regular old evil. It is evil.
That makes sense because it is very generic evil bad thing. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. So Joshua, let's start with you. You have, I feel like, the burden of something you want to unload on me right now.
Possibly, yeah. Like, so I guess maybe I'll like come at it with my my complainos, and then if you or Rebecca have like feedback on those, definitely feel free to chime in. So my biggest problem with this movie is that I felt like it was trying to walk a line between being goofy and being serious. Like, the core part of the movie is essentially a MacGuffin chase, right? For like the box of stones or whatever, the Infinity Stones, the elements.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's a MacGuffin chase, but there's like way too much plot in this movie. And like, mm-hmm. the brilliance about a MacGuffin chase is that you can really just showcase the characters because the plot can be pretty simple. Like, this is a thing that needs to be got and four people are chasing after it. End of the essential part of the plot. And this movie is like incredibly complicated, and I knew nothing about the characters, so I had a hard time caring about any of them, and the plot is like very ridiculous and silly, but then like almost too serious at sections. Like, it's taking itself too seriously. So I had a hard time caring about it. I don't know. That was kind of how I felt watching it. And then the other thing is like the energy and tone of the movie, I just found to be like very grating and exhausting. It was trying too hard at certain parts, and I don't know. It just wasn't my vibe, I guess.
Hmm, interesting. Rebecca, what did you like about this movie? What did you not like about this movie?
I pretty much agree with everything you were just saying, because it was funny because the thing I thought after I finished is I was like, man, it felt like kind of like what like a 15 or a 16 year old boy just sat down and wrote one day, both with like the over simplistic villain of just like a fire monster, but also the like really, you're right, like totally complex, like there's so many different things going on, down to like the like random sex jokes. And then I was reading like a 20th anniversary article about it, and the director was like, oh yeah, I started writing this when I was 16 years old. And I was like, knew it. It
came like 5-6 years ago. Because, you know, when you're young, you have a lot of energy, but you have no experience, so you have nothing to say. You know? So you learn first, and then when you get older, you have the pretension. Now I can say something. Now I know.
I don't know if either of you are very familiar with the other work Luc Besson has done. This is probably his most famous work, if I were to hazard a guess, but he also made a movie in 1994 called Leon the Professional, which is fairly well regarded and
I've never seen Leon the Professional, but I've definitely heard of it, and I was really surprised to find out it was the same director, because they feel like wildly different tones.
Also stars Gary Oldman and has Natalie Portman in it, and then he also released a movie in 2014 called Lucy, which I had forgotten this till I was listening to a interview with Mila Jovovich on mm-hmm. her character, because as many times as I've seen this movie, I didn't put together that she's the perfect human. I thought that she was like some sort of elemental power, but I didn't realize that she was kind of crafted to be what peak humankind would evolve to, and that's what her condensed DNA is supposed to symbolize.
He saw a little bit of her when I didn't have all my sort of faces on. Because, you know, when you're in the city, you've always got your sort of thing of how people perceive you, and you've got your shtick that you do. But, you know, he caught me at a time where I lost control of my thing, and that's what he needed, you know. Well, she's everything. She's the future of mankind. She's like a human being that's so advanced, but that we all can become. Because, you know, for me, I totally believe in opening your brain and being able to talk to people with your mind and move things with your brain. I mean, all that stuff is so interesting. I think we could fly if we only use 4% of our brains in the end. So it's like, imagine if we could use 100% of our brain, and that's what she is. She's like using every inch of her brain that she can, and that's such an inspiration, because it could really happen.
Mila talks about in this interview about how she, as the actress, fully believes that humanity could reach the point where you can evolve into using your brain more. And she talks about how, you know, humans only use 4% of your brain, which is false. That's been disproven. Mm-hmm. But that's the plot of Lucy. Is Scarlett Johansson plays a woman who, like, is given some illegal drugs and suddenly uses her full brain and becomes, like, this unstoppable beast. So interesting themes that I find throughout his movies. And then more recently, I want to say came out in 2016, he released a movie called Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets, mm-hmm. which a lot of people were saying was like the spiritual successor to The Fifth Element, and I was super excited for, because it's got my girl Cara Delevingne in it, and that movie was absolute garbage. Very disappointing. So take that with a grain of salt. But back to this movie, The Fifth Element. I am a fan of modern French films. I'm thinking of like Delicatessen or Amelie or City of Lost Children, I believe it's called. And they have, so Luc Besson is a French person in this movie. Was released in Cannes. That was where it premiered and was definitely kind of targeting the French audience, and I think you can see a lot of the French sensibility in that, the way it's filmed. And I think one of the things that they have in common is they have like an extremely claustrophobic practical effect set dressing. So all the sets in all those movies that I mentioned feel very cluttered almost, and this movie has that similar feeling. I was laughing something I don't know if I've ever noticed before, but just the pile of trash in the airport. And it's not really like the,
oh yeah,
the ticket taker kind of comments on it. She's like, sorry for our trash problem, but it is like the, it's like a trash pile to end all trash piles. It is 2/3 of the building is just one pile of trash. And it's never really commented on as like, you know, why does, is this just New York or what's going on here?
It's just like Mount Trash in the middle of.
Yeah. And, but it's just that kind of claustrophobia and absolute like clutteriness that I found. I just really like that aesthetic, and I find that the practicalness and the physicality of it all really works for me. I also got a lot of Star Wars vibes from this movie, and I don't know. I couldn't find anyone specifically kind of saying that it ripped off Star Wars. I know that there was some lawsuits that it ripped off Alejandro Jodorowsky, who was a guy who people believe Star Wars was ripped off of. So, but that lawsuit was thrown out because it wasn't found to be factual. But the spaceships definitely had a Star Wars feel to them, and some of the aliens definitely had a Star Wars look to them. So it definitely, if not directly, was influenced by Star Wars.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because I picked up on like a lot of different things that I remember from the Solo movie within this movie. Like a lot of that airport has pretty similar vibes with the stuff that's in Solo. A lot of different things, and like how dirty everything is a pretty reminiscent of Solo. So that'd be kind of funny if, you know, like Star Wars OG inspires the Fifth Element, and then the Fifth Element in turn kind of inspires the look of Solo.
That's but, funny. Yeah. I didn't look. I watched it on you know, YouTube Movies on VOD, and I didn't look to see if it was a remastered version, but I thought that the special effects and the really just the look of it was very well, still held up very well. Presumably it had been remastered somewhat, but I thought it all looked really good, even the spaceship scenes. And
yeah, I read that they used a lot of practical stuff in terms of they didn't ever do anything on a green screen for the actors is what they said. But then obviously, like, there's CGI added on, but I think they really tried to be as practical as possible.
Yeah.
And I think that that comes across for sure. Like, I don't really have any issues with the art direction of this movie. And I mentioned it in my review that I left for it on Letterboxd, but I do appreciate how visually striking this movie is and how it actually has a visual identity. You could look at almost any frame from this movie, and if you're familiar with it, recognize what it's from. And I think that that's something that you don't get from like Striking Distance or the Last Stand or any of these other, like, even Die Hard 2, like kind of middling action-y movies. This movie has an identity. I just didn't like that identity.
No, that's fair. Another thing talking about the visual aesthetic is the use of the color orange. And I really like the color orange. My water bottle is orange. My car is orange. I love that color. And not only is...
Your favorite president is orange, you know.
Oh, get out of here. I'm sorry, folks. We've lost Josh. His connection appears to have dropped. He got into an accident and lost both of his ears.
What's that? I can't hear you. A U-Haul just ran over both my ears.
But this movie loves the color orange. So not only is Lulu, not only is her hair orange, her outfit in the latter half of the movie is orange. Bruce Willis's character of Corbin Dallas wears a lot of orange. It's usually sunset frequently in New York, so that everything is orange hued. The general costumes are very orange. So I thought I loved that use of color. I thought the costumes in general were really fun and inventive. Mm-hmm. I love how this is not the only movie to do this, but people in the 90s knew that the police in the future were going to be heavily armored. They just assumed that heavily armor was going to be like cardboard boxes looking and you would walk like robots, because the armor looks so impractical and they look like they're wearing just buckets on their head. But it is so funny to me.
I mean, honestly, all of the costuming in this movie is pretty impractical if we're going to review it by that standard.
I just get like nothing but Power Rangers or Super Mario Bros. Movie vibes from everything in this movie.
This movie had a pretty big budget too. I think that, you know, it wasn't like for lack of trying, but and Gary Oldman's whole entourage and their plastic head tops.
Yeah.
God.
I just loved it all. Gary Oldman is playing, you know, full form here.
Oh, I read in the IMDb trivia that he played his character as a mix between Bugs Bunny and then presidential candidate Ross Perot.
Yeah, I read that too. Wild.
Yeah, having watched some of Ross Perot, I'm like, actually, you know, that I believe it.
That's funny. I just rewatched it again yesterday, and I was like, man, his accent is really just kind of an interesting choice here. It's like half drawl, half like well-to-do, you know, kind of just kind of a, like a unique accent.
Yeah,
it's like
apparently
Moira
he
from
can't
Schitt's Creek.
Oh, totally. Yeah, and apparently he can't stand this movie at all. Like, he hates it.
Yeah, because I think he just did it because the director like funded his movie or something, so he did it as a
favor.
Yeah,
that's right. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, I saw that.
We didn't know nothing about the movie. Nothing about it. Even Bruce Willis didn't know till he got to London and he read the script. I read the script when I got to London, but it was right before we started filming. So we only took what Luc Besson told us, and we had to go by that. And it was kind of hard, but it was kind of fun in a way, because kept me excited about what was going to happen. It was surprising. Every day it was something different, and it was like, it was real fun. And I'm glad he did it that way, because, you know, you had to always, you get up in the morning, you know, you don't know what to expect. And it was a real good experience. And my part was a stretch for me, because I never did anything like that before, and it was so far from me and what I do in America's stand-up comedy. You know, I do, like, reality jokes and stuff, and my movies that I usually do are reality, like, based of America situations and stuff. It was nothing like that. But when I got there, and John Paul Gaultier, I seen all his clothes that he wanted me to wear. I was like, oh, this ain't gonna be nothing like I ever done before.
Boy, it's huge, like fire!
I would never wear this stuff in the street.
So stop melting, ladies, because the boy is hotter than hot.
So I was like, shit. This go be hard. And John Paul Gaultier was like, this is beautiful on you. You would like this. I was like, no, I do not like that. But I start wearing the stuff, and I start getting into the character, and it helped. The costume helped me create that character a lot. So I thank John Paul Gaultier for that.
Chris Tucker is probably my favorite part of this movie. His ridiculous portrayal of Ruby Rod, the DJ, is so funny. I repeatedly just laugh out loud every time I watch him saying, my man, Dallas, my man, over and over again. He never gets old.
Yeah. He's one of my favorite parts. And honestly, I'm going to start like buzzing people away when they annoy me.
Yeah. I totally agree. As soon as he popped up on screen, I was going, oh God, I'm going to hate this character. And then I was like, oh no, this is actually amazing. Good job. I read that apparently they based the character on like kind of a Michael Jackson and Prince-esque like vibe. And then they were then like, oh, maybe we can get Prince to be in our movie.
I was totally getting Prince vibes.
Loved to have seen that. Yeah. But yeah, they totally nailed that.
I don't know the comedic timing Prince could have pulled off, but I mean, Prince obviously would have sang more. Chris Tucker sings a couple lines in this for a little bit and does some raps and stuff that are fun. But yeah, I was like, oh, this is like a role made for Prince right here.
The other person I read was in the running for it was Jamie Foxx, which they just didn't pick him because he was so much bigger physically and they liked the look of Chris Tucker next to Bruce Willis. Mm. But that would have been really interesting too, I think.
Yeah, I don't.
That would have been wild.
That would have been a different movie, I think. I mean, yeah. I don't know. I don't know if Chris Tucker has done another role since then that's like this. Like, it's very. I don't know if it's quite what I would say is gender fluid, but it's definitely a queer character. Mm-hmm. He's wearing almost dresses, you know, flowery dresses, very flirtatious, over the top, on and off camera for his quote unquote role. So, it's a very. Very comedic character, and I think Jamie Foxx could have done the comedy. I just don't know if he could have been as I don't know if sexual or sensual. Chris, he's very sensual with his like unicorn hairpiece and everything.
Oh yeah, that whole like plane takeoff sequence, I was low-key dying.
Yeah. And then Ian Holm.
Mummy.
I don't know what he had done before this movie. Probably some stuff, right?
Alien. Think...
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's an alien. That. He's like my favorite part of Alien.
He was a joy in this movie. And I kind of was, I was like, oh, I hope he doesn't just disappear in the beginning after the, sits down at the bar and gets drunk with the bartender robot and is. Maybe I shouldn't have sent a kid off to his demise.
Kendrick.
Yeah.
He was in Brazil.
He was? What was he in Brazil?
He's a Mr. Kurtzman, apparently, according to IMDb.
I totally forgot that role.
I'm just like scrolling through his IMDb. I'm like, wait a second. You're supposed to be Mr. Brazil.
Yeah. I don't know if I would say Mr. Brazil, but you could. That was my father.
Captain Brazil. Sorry.
So, yeah, loved him in this movie. But so all that to say, I do agree with you that the plot is convoluted, and it's hard to separate myself from the fact that I've seen this movie a half a dozen times at least to mm-hmm. have the fresh look of how convoluted the plot is. Because I'm at the point now where I love the watching all the different plot lines coalesce to the resort, Floss in Paradise. Cause you know, you have, Gary Oldman, you have the aliens he double crossed, the, you know, Gennaro bad guy, pig creatures. You have Ian Holm, you have Bruce Willis, you have the
opera singer.
The opera singer that they're trying to meet. So, and then you have Chris Tucker, and you have all these kind of disparate parts. And you're like meeting all of them, and then it's all kind of happening at once. And I would have loved to like watch this in mini series format, where it's like an entire episode devoted to each of those, and then the finale is the end. But so I can see where this plot is very confusing. I think if you just kind of sit back and let it roll over you, and you're just basking in the absolute ridiculousness of it all, that's kind of how I fell in love with it.
Yeah, I think originally this movie was going to be a trilogy. I think I read that somewhere. And that probably would have helped a lot of the issue, because I could see the plot from this movie being stretched over three movies to be quite digestible and allow even more room for fleshing out the characters. I just think that when they got the news that they were only going to do one movie, you have to take out a lot of different things. And you can have a movie that has a lot of different moving pieces and stuff like that, but there's so many things that were just like unnecessary. Like that opening sequence where they're in Egypt, we get introduced to the idea of there being this fifth element thing, but that's like it. And that's maybe 10 to 15 minutes, or at least 10 minutes of the movie is that opening segment. And that's time where I feel like you could have better spent that, you know, fleshing out the world a little bit more, because they kind of just explain, they reference things about the world. Like they reference that Bruce Willis has 50 points or 5 points or whatever, but then they don't really explain it, or they don't really show it. And so you're just kind of left being like, well, I guess I'll go read the graphic novel that explains what these points mean after this.
Yeah. It's so funny you mentioned the points. So I watched this movie with a friend of the show, DK, hashtag DK Bakes on Instagram, and he asked me, he was like, wait, what do the points mean on the, when they talk about his points on his license, how do they reference that? And they don't ever, again, they don't explain it, and you just kind of have to assume it's something to do with being able to drive a car, I guess. I don't know, like I understand where you're coming from, and I can't disagree that that part is confusing, but I feel like it's just shorthand for kind of moving forward. What's funny is this plot is, at its base, it is like a video game-esque plot that should be fairly straightforward. You know, bad guys coming, we need the four elements plus the girl. Okay, we got mm-hmm. the girl, now we need the elements, now we go find the elements, we got the elements, now we got to get back, now we got to turn them on, now we're good. That part is fairly straightforward, but there is like some extraneous stuff that is unnecessary. I think probably my least favorite parts are the parts to do with the monstery aliens, and that is where most of the action comes in. This movie, we haven't done a Bruce Willis movie in a little while that has as much just straight action as this movie has. The middle third is very heavy gunfight action. Mila Jovovich's character of Lilo does a bunch of stunt work, you know, martial art action. I thought that was really fun. I love that whole scene where she's fighting guys to the opera singer. The whole opera singer scene.
Oh, yeah, that was pretty great.
So good.
Where she, like, goes from opera into pop hip-hop. Part was great. And I don't know if those monster aliens were added to just give this movie some action. If the trailer definitely wants you to think it's a more dramatic action movie than I think it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's weird too. Yeah. They spend so much time on these aliens and then there's like really no motivation or anything given to the actual like ultimate villain of, you know, Fireball with a skull face.
Yeah. Rekka, he's here to kill life. He comes every 5,000 years to kill life. Yeah, and so another thing that I don't know if it's commented on in the graphic novel, but when
that,
Lulu
that
gets to...
we're imagining into existence.
Yeah. fan fiction, Josh. I'm writing fan fiction right now. Okay. It's involving moonlighting. It's a moonlighting Fifth Element crossover.
Oh, I see.
There's a very brief moment given to it when she gets to the W in her language studies, and you see her kind of realize in the last 5,000 years, humanity has like really advanced its warfare concepts, and it goes through, because you think about 5,000 years, a lot has happened, you know, gunpowder and gasoline and atomic bombs and electricity, all that stuff's created a lot of weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of get the impression that that overwhelms her. And at the end, she's like, do I really want to save humanity? But that's not really talked about. It's just kind of brushed aside. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something else that could have been fleshed out in a longer piece or just cut entirely.
Yeah. And well, when I was watching it. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, it kind of cracks me up that she really only focuses on war in the 20th century. I'm like, well, interesting that I guess war stopped then. That's pretty good.
I know. I was like, what's happened in the last 200 years? Because, or 300 years. Well, for us now, it's only been about 200 years. Mm-hmm. But so in the next 200 years, we're going to invent extremely fast spaceships, meet untold amount of aliens, mm-hmm. and completely pollute the Earth, which I think we're pretty good on one out of those three. So.
Yeah. Good for us.
One of the things that I thought was super silly about this movie was its concept of time, and because you're continually never told how much time is passing, and it's just like repeatedly they'll be like, oh, we need thing XYZ, and they turn around and someone's handing it to them, or like mm-hmm. the cops are like, we need to call in a flying unit, and it is immediately there, mm-hmm. or they're like, okay, we got to fly to this other planet, da-ding, we're there. I don't know if that was just a choice or coincidence or shoddy writing or what it was, but I thought it was pretty wild that we're kind of supposed to feel the pressure, the surmounting pressure of expando ball evil, mm-hmm. but
speaking
we're
of,
never told like how much time anything takes.
Speaking of time being different in different places, I like that New York's like in like the 24th century, but Egypt is still in like 500 BC.
It's
just like
a desert.
I know,
guess.
But
yeah.
There's like no city, no nothing, just desert.
Yep. I mean, even today when you see those pictures of the pyramids, they never show you that the pyramids are in a metropolitan city.
Yeah.
So there's a city right around them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good point.
Something else I was going to bring up about yeah. Big O Ball Bad Guy is it felt like a C-tier level Star Trek villain from like an episode that Picard would have to talk to and show the humanity of people and stuff like that, or they'd have to like transfer their computer core to them and then they'd be like, oh, humanity is not worth destroying after all, and then fly off into the distance. Pretty sure that actually is an episode.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but anyways, I just found it impossible to care about this thing because, like you're saying, Kendrick, it kept doing these like weird time jumps, and so they'd be like, the world is about to be destroyed, time to take a 3-week vacation to this other place or whatever.
Yeah.
And like, it doesn't matter until it does at the very end. And then when they're at the end of the movie and they're like, this thing is going to reach Earth in 30 seconds. I counted and it was like a minute and a half.
Yeah.
And you're like, what?
Well,
What?
Also, when the bomb is counting down on that cruise ship, it gets to zero, and then two more seconds pass, and then it blows up.
Yeah.
I think what I love about this movie the most is its great world building and ridiculous characters, and the plot is just not worth it. Like, bad guy does bad things, good guys do good things. That's about it.
Yeah. I just wanted a smidgen more characters.
It is a real bummer. We don't know Gary Oldman's, his reasoning. He seems to be the most wealthiest and powerful man on Earth. We're not really told, but he's
just going to believe that he's future Jeff Bezos.
Yeah. After Jeff Bezos comes back to Earth, he's going to have no hair. Well, I guess he already has no hair. He's just going to put a piece of plastic on his head. I thought it was interesting. I don't know if you noticed this, but you remember in our moonlighting discussion, we talked about consent and the 80s concept of consent and how Bruce Willis in Moonlighting kisses Sybil Shepherd until she finally lets him have sex with her. And in this movie, he kisses Lilo when she's passed out and she points a gun at him. And then he goes, I should not have done that. And then she says in her language, like, do not kiss me unless I give you permission. And I was like, oh, how far we've advanced in 10 years.
Yeah, that honestly, is true. Yeah, I was honestly pretty surprised by that whole discussion that way as well. That it went that way instead of being like, how great, he kissed her.
However, this movie did help originate the, like, trope born sexy yesterday.
Yeah, literally.
The whole, like,
it did. Yeah. And I that's another Luc Besson trademark is of the femme fatale, kind of the female character who one of, man strong, woman pretty. That's like how you describe his characters.
Classic.
Yeah.
He actually went on to marry Mila Jovovich, which is interesting because I think he was much older than her. But then Bruce Willis was also like 20 years older than her in this movie as well.
Was what other movies had she done before this? Much of anything?
I don't think anything really, because she was only like 20.
It looks like she did some TV spots and some short films before. But yeah, this was pretty much it. Oh, she was in Zoolander? I forgot about that. I haven't seen that movie in a long time. It's funny, Josh, that we are so divided on this movie because critics also very divided on this movie.
Oh, yeah.
So it got nominated for many awards, won several awards. It won, some BAFTAs. It won some awards at Cannes. It won the Caesar Award, which presumably is maybe another French or Italian film festival. It was nominated for Best Sound Editing at the Academy Awards. It was nominated for a Blockbuster Entertainment Award, which I haven't looked, but I assume that award ceremony doesn't exist anymore. But also, it was nominated for Golden Raspberries and my favorite, Stinker's Bad Movie.
Hey! Did it achieve a Mr. Stinker's Bad Movie Award?
Nope. It didn't win a Stinkers. It didn't win a Golden Raspberry. It got a Golden Raspberry nomination for Mila Jovovich and Chris Tucker.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and a Stinker's Bad Movie for Worst Picture, Worst Director, and Chris Tucker and Mila Jovovich also. Yeah, it's definitely cult classic at this point. Like, I think most people who like it are like me, who either weren't old enough or didn't watch it when it came out and have since fell in love with it. But it kind of split a lot of critics when it came out. I think Siskel and Ebert gave it like 3 out of 5 stars. They had some problems with it, but they didn't hate it. And mm-hmm. But then other, like, I think LA Times was like, this is quite possibly the worst movie. So, very
interesting.
Divisive.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't think it's like the worst movie ever made or anything like that. I just think it's largely over complimented when maybe it doesn't deserve that.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. We might be hitting the point now where a lot of people see the cult classic status and find that hard to understand. Ebert says, he says, quote, "I would not have missed seeing this film, and I recommend it for its richness of imagery, but at 127 minutes, which seems a reasonable length, it plays long," end quote, which I think sums up what our complaints have been, really.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah. I think I wrote one or two other things I wanted to talk about, too. But if you had something, Rebecca, you wanted to go over, feel free.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, I definitely feel like it felt longer than it really was. And I also feel like there's definitely things that you could have cut out and no one would have ever missed it. I mean, honestly, anything with his mom, I feel like you could have chopped out all of those conversations.
Oh, totally.
Never would have missed it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the... Yeah, the mom stuff. What are your fingers broken? Why haven't you been calling me? All that stuff could have been pulled out. And then a lot of the stuff with Gary Oldman, which is great as it is, it didn't really add to the character. It was just kind of Gary Oldman chewing scenery.
Mm-hmm.
With those kind of pig monsters, you know, the gun sales and that kind of stuff.
The weird little pet thing he had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, him choking on a cherry pit.
Yeah.
I guess that scene, I forgot about that scene, but that scene did kind of help explain his motivation a little bit, where he talked about how you can't have purpose without chaos and destruction.
Which doesn't, I don't buy that entirely.
No, yeah, it doesn't make any sense. His allegory was, I'm going to break a glass and see, something has to clean up this glass. But if you destroy everything everywhere, well, I don't know where you're going to go from there.
Yeah, I never really understood what he was going to do with all the money he was apparently getting if everything was destroyed.
Yeah, I don't know. Who cares?
That's why, bad guys who can destroy everything don't make any sense if they are doing it for money. Because it's like, you're holding us hostage, but you're going to destroy everything, which will kill you, too, so you don't want that. Because, at their core, they're selfish. But if you have a villain more like the Avengers Thanos, who has, a motivation that is more like ethical and more morality based, you can do a lot more interesting stuff with it. And I feel like if they had based him in something that wasn't just wanting to be future Jeff Bezos, they probably would have had a better villain on their hands. But my biggest problem with this movie is the writing. From everything that I've said, these are all writing issues. So it's yet another thing that I will throw in the tin, but I don't want to beat a dead horse and just say the writing's bad 65 different ways. So I will, I'll just leave it there, I guess.
Okay. Anything we want to talk about this movie before we move on? Any last thoughts?
One thing I did think was interesting is watching it. It had, obviously, it's a lot brighter and more colorful, but in a lot of ways, it reminded me somewhat of Blade Runner, just with the whole lots of big advertisements and the huge McDonald's signs and
so many McDonald's references.
Yeah, and it was interesting too, because with a lot of McDonald's and the cigarettes he got and the plastic containers in his fridge, a lot of it felt, and all the gas low, and the fog when he drove way down, it felt very the earth is, and all the trash, the earth is being destroyed. And then in this 20th anniversary thing, they were we wanted to show a bright, happy, great future that wasn't dark and depressing like Blade Runner. And I was really?
What did you all think of the traveling sushi chef or ramen chef or whatever that was? I thought that was pretty great. He just comes to your door.
Yeah, a whole conversation about luck and stuff.
Yeah, your pod window, and he's in his Chinese junk, but also a spaceship version of it.
I don't know how he's supposed to make money doing that, though, because he stood and had a conversation with Bruce Willis for ever.
Maybe Bruce Willis is paying him a lot. I don't know. Maybe, yeah, I don't know.
He got his lunch for free.
He did. He did get his lunch for free. There's just so many, like I said, the world building in this movie is, it's like It's like, I don't know if either of you have ever played Dungeons and Dragons, but it's like if someone just put all their effort into the world building, but had no plot, and the characters just kind of wandered around for a while. Like the fact, we haven't even talked about, his apartment has designated spaces for standing when you get the police raiding your house. Like, that's pretty dystopian and wild. And the neighbor who robs him by having a hat that looks like an empty hallway.
Oh yeah, that was great.
So random.
And then Bruce Willis is just like, I'll take this gun and add it to my giant stash of guns.
Another thing that felt totally random was what was with the little like critters under the plane and the like Rastafarian type guy underneath smoking something.
I think that it was, to me, I just got that it was, they were making it as if it was just an airplane. They wanted to go like complete airplane goof instead of any sort of spaceship, Star Trek-esque spaceship or even Star Wars-esque spaceship. And those are just the guys, you know, out there filling up the plane. The killing of critters, I don't know. We'll get to the budget in a little bit. I don't actually know anything about the budget, Josh, so hopefully you have that number pulled up.
Ooh, yeah, but, I got that ready to go.
I have to feel like this movie cost a lot of money. Okay, so let's talk about Star Trek Connection real quick. That's all right with you too. So if this is your first time listening, one of the features of the Where There's a Will, There's a Way podcast is we help you by finding the way you can connect this movie to Star Trek, which I know is probably really helpful for everyone out there who needs everything to connect to Star Trek. So with that said, the one connection I found was a man named John Neville. He plays in a Star Trek Next Generation episode where he is playing the character of Isaac Newton. And in this movie, he's one of the generals in one of the military generals, General Staydert, I think is how you say his name. He's most well known for playing Baron Munchausen in the Terry Gilliam movie Baron Munchausen, which is funny because if you look at his IMDb, he always wears big British style wigs, and his character of Isaac Newton on Star Trek, he was wearing a big wig, so very in type for him. So that is the Star Trek connection I pulled up for this movie.
That is fantastic.
Love it.
Since I forgot to mention it, but we were talking earlier about, you mentioned a general and that like Monroe guy. I was like, God, this guy looks so familiar. You know the guy that I'm talking about?
The general head of, Monroe. The head of
the guy who gets
put in a freezer and then is totally fine.
Yeah.
So that guy, I was like, this guy looks familiar. But then I realized he is in a trilogy of Bruce Willis movies, and he's been in three movies that we've watched so far. This is the last one that he's in with Bruce Willis, but I like, could not believe it. He was in The Player, and he was in Striking Distance as well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What was his character in The Player? Oh, just probably background man number seven or something?
No, he was like a kind of a big deal. He was, I think, the like head of the company. Joel Levison was his character's name. He was like in charge of the place that like the main character was working for.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You know,
so
speaking,
I was like, oh wow.
Speaking of recognizing random people, the president, who we didn't really talk about at all either, was such a random character, but I was like, for the longest time, I was like, man, what is this guy in? And he is, this is super random, but it's like the only other thing he's really been in. He was the prisoner in The Dark Knight that like takes the bomb trigger and throws it out the window. Like the really like scary dude. But in this movie, he's so like grinny and like constantly sweating and just being very like over the top. It took me a long time to make that connection.
He plays a very strange president character, and I don't know how he was directed, but he definitely acts almost kind of stilted and like he's reading everything from a teleprompter. But I thought it was kind of funny. This movie was kind of groundbreaking, and it had a black president. I don't think it was the first, but for its time.
Yeah, I know. Luc Besson was like, I wanted to do things, you know, everyone said you couldn't. Like, the villain dies, not in a big, like battle with the main guy. And the president's black. Like, I think he was trying to kind of be a bit of a contrarian in some of his choices.
Well, and I love how, like, Bruce Willis and Gary Oldman do not share a single scene together. They share, like, a couple of frames together, Scooby-Doo style, where, like, one group gets off the elevator and the other gets on an elevator, and then they don't see each other, which was fantastic. Yeah, good stuff. Like I said, I did like parts of this movie, but overall I was just like, writing. The writing was the big downer for me. But, yeah. Okay, so box office for this movie. The box office for this movie was honestly kind of incredible. It is, to date, the second highest box office, the second highest budget movie adjusted for inflation.
Wow.
And it was a $90 million movie.
So when you say second highest, do you mean of the ones we've done so far?
Of the ones we've done so far, yeah. Die Hard with a Vengeance was also 90 million, but it was made in 95. So 90 million in 95 is more than 90 million in 97. Because of inflation. But yeah, this movie was $90 million to make, and it made $263.9 million at the box office.
Wow. That's
so cool. Definitely a good return, but it was an expensive movie.
Yeah. I'll say that, you could see it on the screen, I think.
Yeah,
for sure.
And there's so many random little one-off characters, like all the stewardesses and like the McDonald's girl, like so many random characters like that, that they definitely put a lot of effort and detail into everything they're wearing and their wigs and all kinds of stuff.
Oh, their costumes are always so weird. The stewardesses' weird costumes. Yeah, the wigs, the makeup, everything. That little makeup machine that Lilo has where she's like, you just hold it up to your eyes and it just does all your makeup for you.
Yeah. I thought that it was one of those, like, what were they called that were back in the 90s and the early 2000s, but you put them up to your eyes and then you flick a button and it goes through a reel.
Oh, the, where you're like looking at the picture thing.
Yeah. And then it's like,
I don't know, dinosaurs,
and you like flick through them and they're really hard to see in low light.
I know what you're talking about. I don't know what the name is, though.
Ah, God damn it.
Speaking of makeup, I totally forgot about this until just now. Does anyone have any idea what the whole thing was going on when Zorg was talking to the fireball monster and all of a sudden he just starts bleeding from the center of his forehead?
So that happened earlier when the first general dies after firing all the missiles they had at it. Right before he dies, the top of his forehead starts bleeding black blood again. It's never explained. I think it's supposed to symbolize like you're in bad shape.
I guess.
Evil with a capital E is coming.
Oh no, not evil.
Also, I want to call out Gary Oldman's I don't even know how to say this without laughing. His best man or whatever, his character name is Right Arm.
His character name is Right Arm?
Yeah. I was like, I wanted to say his right hand man, but I'd be playing into the joke before I could even get it out.
That's funny. All right.
Man, this movie, I tell you what.
Well, we haven't really touched on it too much, but you guys want to briefly talk about how much we liked Willis's performance in this movie?
So when I was talking earlier and I mentioned the awards this movie was nominated for and got, I found it striking that Bruce Willis did not get any, none of those stinkers were for him. And I don't think any of the positive awards are for him either. And I don't know if that's because he's playing the same character we've seen him play in the like the Die Hard movies and some of the other action movies, he's playing a kind of hard-boiled action star, former, you know, special ops military, very good at his job. We have pretty much everything you'd want from a Bruce Willis movie, from smitten, like able to show a softer side, but also got great one-liners, freaks out, gets upset when his job goes sideways, scrambling to try to solve the problem in his apartment where he has to hide people in the freezer, in the shower, in the bed. And I really liked his performance in this. I don't know. What did you guys think, Rebecca?
I think that he, you know, besides having kind of some unique clothing, he pretty much was probably the most like normal person in the movie. So he doesn't pop or stand out as much as everyone else, but I kind of feel like that was perfect because I think he needed to be that so that they could shine a little bit more, because they had such unique other characters surrounding him that I think it really actually worked well that he was so like straight and narrow and just kind of doing the classic like Bruce Willis thing and not taking too much attention off of like a Chris Tucker or Emilia Jovovich.
One thing we didn't really touch on was for a large chunk of this movie, Milla Jovovich's character doesn't speak English, and she speaks gibberish of some sort, and he's basically doing all the conversation and letting the audience know kind of what's going on. And I thought that all worked really well for me.
Yeah, I agree. I actually read that it was like a real language they created. It didn't have a ton of words, but that she could actually have a conversation with Luc Besson with that gibberish language.
Oh, wow. Josh, what were your feelings?
Yeah, I thought that Bruce Willis did a good job. I wouldn't say that it's like my favorite Bruce Willis performance or anything like that, but I thought it was a well-done performance. Unfortunately, I have a hard time not comparing this movie to 12 Monkeys, and I don't think that he gives like a 12 Monkeys level performance. But he does a fine job with what he's given, I think.
Some films I choose to do because there's some acting thing that I need to work out for myself, or something that I think is challenging, you know, from an acting point of view. And sometimes I do it just because they're just fun, and this was a real fun movie to make.
Now, this is the second film you've made recently that takes a less than sunny view of the future. Is this pure coincidence, or do you just have those old millennium blues?
It's a good question. No, this is, I mean, I think compared to 12 Monkeys, which was a very dark view, a very dismal view of the future, this was more, I did this picture not so much for the science fiction part of it, but just because I wanted to work with Luke, and it just seemed like it would be a big, fun ride to go on, you know, and have all these big toys and fun and get to kiss the girl and everybody lives happily ever after and we save the world. I don't want to give the end of the picture away, but it just seemed like a good idea. It seemed like a lot of fun.
Well, it certainly has paid off for you in spades.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations.
Nice to see you again. Always nice talking to you.
Okay, so all that said, Joshua, where would you put this movie in your ranking of all the Bruce Willis movies?
Even though I had like a lot of fairly positive things to say about it, I think that the writing, it just really knocked it down for me, and I definitely was having a hard time placing where I was going to put this movie. But as I've said before, when I judge movies, I feel like I kind of look at what it's shooting for and what it's aiming to be, and then I evaluate it against that. So, like, Look Who's Talking is pretty much the best movie that Look Who's Talking could have been. And Die Hard 1 is pretty much the best movie that Die Hard 1 could have been. This movie is not the best movie that I feel like Fifth Element could have been. I feel like there's a lot more things on the table that weren't utilized well. The writing is fairly shoddy at parts, and I feel like that definitely affected how much I enjoyed or didn't enjoy the film. So I'm actually going to rank this movie kind of low. I'm putting this movie at my number 15, below Mortal Thoughts and above Billy Bathgate.
All right. Wow. We're going to have a little bit of a divergent list on this one.
Oh, definitely.
So While I saved my Bruce Willis, my full Bruce Willis for this movie, it's not going to be my number one movie. It's not. I think, as much as I love it, I see the flaws in it, and I think while I will probably always be willing to rewatch it, and of the movies we've watched. Maybe only Hudson Hawk is one that I would jump at a rewatch. The other ones I'd want to be in the right mindset. But with that said, I think 12 Monkeys is a more technically proficient movie, and you could have multiple classes on that movie. Fifth Element is just a movie that not everyone can like and not like. So I'm going to put Fifth Element at number two, right behind 12 Monkeys.
Rebecca, obviously you haven't seen every single movie on this list, but at a glance, do you have any idea of where you would put Fifth Element in comparison to
other ones?
What
Josh is trying to say is at a glance, can you tell me how wrong I am?
Well, I mean, honestly, yeah. I haven't seen a ton of these movies, so I mean, I would probably have maybe a list of five, and out of five, I'd probably put it at a solid like three. So about the middle of a list.
Nice.
Well, what do you think is the worst that you've seen of this list?
I mean, it's been a while since I've seen Look Who's Talking, but that one's probably pretty low. And some of the later, like, I don't even know which one. Whichever Die Hard has Justin Long in it.
Oh, we haven't gotten to that one. I think that's Die Hard 4.
Whatever one that one is, that would definitely be down there too.
Yep. Well, you can't take my elements away from me.
It's definitely an enjoyable movie, and a movie that is fun to go back and watch, though. So that makes it much higher than a lot of movies.
Yeah. And every time I watch it, I'm finding something new, or I'm like, man, that is absolutely ridiculous. Like the whole gag where everybody shows up to the ticket taker booth with the same name, and the ticket taker is like, "You're Corbin Dallas? I've had three people." And then she's just like, "Well, sorry," and she just hits a button and just disappears into the ground. Oh man. Okay, well, Joshua, how many elements do you need to tell you the time of day?
I usually just say one, the element of Kendrick.
Oh, wow. Am I the sixth element?
You are the sixth element.
Too bad we have... I don't know. How far away is the sixth sense? Because then we'll have a... We've done Four Rooms, Fifth Element, Sixth Sense.
12 Monkeys.
12. He's not in the movie Seven.
Isn't number 11 or whatever?
Oh, yeah. Lucky number 11. Yeah,
that'll have to be our stand-in.
That's funny. Never even. That's funny. But seriously, though, Josh, do you know what time it is?
I'm going to guess that by you asking me this, it is time to whisk the Wheel of Willis.
The Wheel of Willis. What we do here on this podcast is we've compiled using the
advanced algorithms.
Yeah, the most advanced of algorithms, the most top of men. To research for us a selection of questions to ponder with this movie. And if you want to be one of those people who suggest suggestions for the Wheel of Willis, we would love them. We try not to reuse these suggestions, so we ask that if you have any ideas for what to add, you can shoot us an email, williswaypod@gmail.com. And just tell us what weird questions you want us to ask ourselves about each of these movies. And if you know what your idea of the seventh element would be, you can tweet at us at Willis Way Pod and use the hashtag the seventh element.
I'm excited to see that trend. Two.
Yeah.
Well, do you know what we do every time we spin the Wheel of Willis?
Rebecca, I hope you're ready, because every time we spin the Wheel of Willis, we say in unison, unedited, raw, and natural,
Whisk that wheel! Flawless. Okay. Would you rather give this Bruce Willis a makeover or let him give you a makeover?
Do you think we could use the futuristic eye makeover device, or we have to do it in?
I'm going to say it's like a YouTube challenge. Let Bruce Willis do my makeup.
I would let him do my makeup or my face, whatever that may be. Trim my beard. Give me orange suspenders. Rebecca, what about you?
I would totally let him do a makeover on me. He's got the cool jacket with the super big shoulder pads and the orange, like the bleached hair. I'm into it. I totally let him give me a makeover.
Yeah, I'm gonna also agree, because if Bruce Willis messes me up, then bummer. But if I mess this Bruce Willis up, I feel like he could kill me or throw me out of a window or something. So
he'll stick you in the freezer.
Yeah, yeah. I'll get stuck in the freezer, or have to hide in a bed and get saran wrapped. Because who doesn't love smelling their freshly preserved bed from the morning? God. Oh man. As Kendrick mentioned earlier, if anybody wants to rate us on Apple Podcasts, we would love that. You can head on over to Apple Podcasts and then just search for Where There's a Willis, There's a Way, and leave us a little review.
You can send us an email, like we said, williswaypod@gmail.com. Find us on Twitter and Instagram @williswaypod. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us. It has been a absolute joy.
Thanks for having me. It's been super fun. I'm glad we got to do this.
Yeah, me too. Is there anything you want listeners to know about anything you want to plug?
Not specifically. You can follow me on Instagram or Twitter on BeccaB96, but that's about it.
Nice. You can find me on Twitter @KMartinix. That's KMartinix.
And you can find me on Twitter @JoshingCarter. Next week, next time, next episode, we'll be covering some animated delights, aka Beavis and Butthead and Bruno the Kid. Until then, keep your way Willis.
Hashtag seventh element.
Well, thank you everybody for listening. Have a good one.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Oh, yes, it's fun then.